Hi, everybody, and welcome to Geraldo, the podcast. I'm Geraldo Rivera. This is episode 2. Let me start right out with talking about the presidential transition. That was the period between November 8th, Election Day, and the presidential inaugural, the swearing in as the 45th president, January 20th. During that period, that wild and crazy period, I commented often about how disappointing I found the efforts to delegitimize President Trump's election. Now, there are certainly, and I don't mean to say there weren't a lot of things to be pissed off about. Hillary Clinton did win the popular vote by almost 3 million votes. The Russians stunk up the whole process with the dirty tricks that they engineered through WikiLeaks. The FBI Director James Comey, who I see has just been reappointed to his job by the new administration, or rather he has announced that he's staying on. I mean, he totally freaked out the second week before the election when he released that bogus story about Hillary Clinton's emails being found on Uma Aberdeen's computer. So really, there were a lot of things that made it very difficult for Hillary Clinton to win, but she really put on a terrible campaign. You've got to face it. That's the real reason she lost. She was such a lame candidate. You know, I like her personally. I certainly like her policies a lot more than I like Donald Trump's policies. But she was really a very weak candidate. I mean, she seemed physically infirm. She seemed to lack, in Trump's term, energy. She wavered on defending herself. I mean, she did great. I mean, if her whole campaign was the way she behaved during that totally bogus Benghazi hearing, it would have been a lot better for her during the election. But also, you know, she didn't campaign at all in Wisconsin. She didn't go to Michigan. And the Constitution, get over it, the Constitution provides that the real vote for the presidency is in the Electoral College, and she got trounced in the Electoral College, and it was her fault. She should have gone to the Midwest. She should have been paying attention. But people on the left have to get over it. I mean, Al Gore had a much bigger beef. Remember, he lost the election by 500 votes in Florida, and he would have won if there was a legitimate recount. But he got over it. He made a speech, and everybody went on, and George W. Bush was inaugurated as the 43rd president, and, you know, history marched on. But we really have to get things together. We really have to get things together, and we have one president. Now, that doesn't mean you agree with him. That doesn't mean you roll over when he says something outrageous or adopts some policy that's obnoxious. But you just have to really get over this whole legitimacy issue, because it's a bogus issue. I recently found out, you know, I like Donald Trump. I like him as a person. I've known him forever. And I reacted with humility when I discovered that I was one of 41 people that President Trump follows on Twitter, which still seems to be his go-to method of communicating with the American people. And I take that honor really profoundly. I expect that it really will impact my tweets. I'm going to write my tweets knowing that he's reading them, whether I agree with him or I disagree with him. I'm going to make very clear that I'm giving him my best, most thought-out position on whatever it is that I'm tweeting about. And if you don't think you can make a point in 140 characters, then you don't use Twitter very often. The president and I spoke on the night of his controversial inaugural address, January 20th. I did not like the inauguration. I mean, I liked the inauguration. I did not like his inaugural address. I thought that it was way too harsh. It was way too tough guy, uncompromising. There was no inspirational language. There was no language that would be designed to bring us together as a nation. I was disappointed in that. But when we spoke, I mean, it's cool to speak to the president of the United States, especially on the day he got elected. I was with Sean Hannity, and with the Fox and Friends co-host Ainsley Earhart, who's a lovely person inside and out. We were backstage hiding from the euphoric crowd that was gathered at the Freedom Ball. That was one of the three official balls. It was at the Washington, D.C. Convention Center. Sean was covering the ball. He had a two-hour live special that night from 10 to midnight Eastern time. Ainsley and I were there to give color commentary about the inaugural festivities and, you know, who was wearing what and who was saying what. And the show was really very, very successful. We're giving our take, basically, on the day's historic events. You know, Sean Hannity is an interesting person. I mean, we don't agree about anything. And yet, I think he's probably my best friend in the business right now because he's such a sincere person. He's so supportive. He's generous. He's compassionate. You know, he's got his point of view and I've got mine, but I really love the guy. It's great hanging out with him, and especially when it's him and Bo Dietl. We have a ball together. I have a headache right now from hanging out with Bo last night. But Sean, through his unfailing support of the president and his vigorous advocacy during the entire campaign, has become, like it or not, one of President Trump's closest unofficial advisors. I mean, Sean really, I think, gives him more guidance than many of the people who are in government. And that's, you know, when you trust your friend, that's what you do. And previous presidents have certainly done it. There's certainly nothing inappropriate about it. The president trusts Sean, and the other way around. But anyway, Sean had the president's old cell phone number, which was very interesting, and he dialed it. And to all of our surprise, it still worked. I mean, that number has now been shut down. It was shut down permanently midnight on January 20th, that wild night. So Sean spoke first, and he handed the phone to Ainsley, and she spoke to the president. I couldn't hear because it was so noisy. I mean, the D.C. Convention Center is a cavernous hall, really a bleak place, horrible place to have a party. There were no tables. Anyway, that party really didn't do it for me. It wasn't exactly Oscar night. But anyway, we spoke to the president. I didn't hear what they said or were saying to the president, to the 45th president. When it was my turn, I congratulated him warmly. I alternated as I was speaking with him between calling him Mr. President, which is the appropriate address when you're talking to the President of the United States, and Boss. I called him Boss. Boss was the nickname I used during the Celebrity Apprentice run. You know, it was his final season, and I was lucky to be on it. I had a great run. I came in second to Lisa Gibbons, but he was very, very solid toward me, our friendship, our long-term friendship, President Trump was. And I think that he did a great job on that show. And remember, I told you in the first episode how important the fact that he outrated Arnold Schwarzenegger on a regular basis is to him, even with everything else on his mind, everything else going on. So when I spoke to the president, he was en route to the ball that we were attending, the Freedom Ball. He went to the Liberty Ball, which actually is in the same building, different floor. Liberty Ball sucked just as badly as the Freedom Ball in terms of, you know, kind of lame-ish entertainment and, you know, no place to sit down. The bar was open. I think it was a cash bar also. So he was en route. He had his glamorous first lady with him, of course, Melania, who looked sensational, didn't she? I mean, she really channeled Jackie Kennedy in every way, elegant, stylish, really smart-looking. His kids were also in the convoy, their spouses, everybody ecstatic, obviously, that elaborate presidential convoy. Now, to my surprise, talking to the president, he wasn't merely accepting my warm wishes. He was combative. He was angry and criticizing the media for underestimating, in his words, the size of the crowd that attended his address to the world, to the nation, from the National Mall there. He was, in our conversation, really going off on the dishonest media, really pissed off that they underestimated the size of his crowd. Now, I don't think that the media was wrong. I think that Donald Trump's crowd was way smaller, certainly, maybe half the size of President Obama in 2009. I think that also it was smaller than President Obama the second time around in 2013. And I'm sorry you got into that beef, because Sean Spicer, when he finally got his act together after a very, very rocky start, the White House press secretary, he phrased it correctly, and I tweeted out, and I'm not sure, but I hope that's where they got it from, that in terms of the entire number of people who saw or heard the inaugural address in the country and around the world, it was the most popular or the most listened to or watched inaugural address in history, for the simple fact that we didn't have the internet as sophisticated as we do today in terms of Facebook carrying it and live streaming and, yes, Twitter following everybody, all the various digital outlets all carried it all around the world, every network. The networks rated like crazy. Fox News, easily number one. I was proud to have been part of that effort. When you count up all the people who saw the inaugural address or heard it, clearly it was the most watched or most listened to inaugural address in the history of the planet. So that's right. But it wasn't right that President Trump said there were 1.5 million people. There weren't 1.5 million people on the National Mall. They just weren't. I mean, I was there. They weren't. There's lots of space. And that's for a lot of reasons. I mean, the red state people that voted for Donald Trump, basically, overwhelmingly working class white people who come from places like the Deep South or those Midwestern states where Hillary forgot to campaign, and they don't have the money to come to Washington. And if you're going to talk about the local audience taking the subway in, all the counties that surround the district are all Democrat counties. They all went for Hillary Clinton overwhelmingly. So if you were someone who wanted to support the 45th president when he was being sworn into office, and you worked in a regular job making $30,000, $40,000 a year, and you had to take time off to come all the way to Washington, D.C., that's why the crowd was small. I mean, there's a logical reason for the crowd being smaller. But, I mean, to argue about whose is bigger anyway is kind of a silly argument, particularly because when it comes to something like crowd size, that's a fact issue. It's either bigger or smaller or the same size, and it's easily measured. Use satellite data, use drone photos, pictures out of high windows. There's a million ways. Subway rides. A million ways you can judge the size of the crowd. And Donald Trump's crowd was smaller than the previous two inaugurations. But again, his audience worldwide in terms of, you know, who all heard his angry address, it was definitely the biggest, most popular ever. So I soothed him as best as I could, and I promised to watch his back, and I will watch his back. I'm not going to let people take unfair shots at him the same way I'm not going to roll over for him either. A couple hours later, I mean, after not even a couple of hours, but I guess it was a couple of hours because we were backstage before the event because there was a buildup and security and all the rest. So it was a couple of hours after the conversation, he and the family showed up at our ball, the Freedom Ball, at the convention center. And they came on stage. It was just the president and the first lady. And they danced to Paul Anka's My Way, you know, the wonderful song. They did it my way. It became Frank Sinatra's anthem in 1969. But I'm telling you, My Way was seldom more appropriately used than it was on inauguration night 2017. I mean, Donald Trump did it his way, no doubt about it. The next day, as you know, there was a gigantic gender revolt, larger by far than the inaugural crowd, and it manifested itself on the streets of the Capitol or all around the country. It was a vast sea of mostly women and girls hitting the streets to demonstrate against Trump's ascendancy to the highest office in the land. It was, I think, certainly perhaps the largest, biggest day of protest in American history. Biggest ever. Bigger than Vietnam. Biggest ever. Millions of demonstrators in 600 different cities in the United States and around the world. I mean, they even demonstrated in Antarctica. My 11-year-old got a big kick out of the fact that there was a demonstration there with mostly penguins and scientists. And the thing that motivated most of them, I think, and many of my my family, not my wife, but many of the folks in my family attended, my in-laws attended various demonstrations in D.C. or other cities. And what motivated most of them, I think, was the fear that Mr. Trump is hell-bent on restricting abortion rights, you know, going against the whole pro-choice movement and defunding Planned Parenthood and so forth, which I hope he is not. But we'll know when the rubber hits the road and it comes time for him to name the nominee to the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, this first nominee I don't care so much about because this person is replacing Antonin Scalia, who was the most ferociously anti-abortion member of the high court ever. So the person that replaces the late Justice Scalia, who incidentally was a good guy, nevertheless, you know, you can't work at Fox News and not respect people who are pro-life. I mean, they just have a different value system. They think life genuinely begins at conception, and that's it. That's their belief system. And so I don't really care who, not that I don't care. I just think that he has a freebie on this first Supreme Court appointee because whoever he picks can't be any more conservative than Justice Scalia was, the late Justice Scalia was. So he's kind of filling the right-wing seat on the high court. So he really has a gimme. He can pick anybody he wants, and I think that people should give him slack in that regard. Now, the demonstrators used the color pink, and I think they used it very, very cleverly to symbolize their profound disquiet that the reins of power now have been handed to a chief executive who allegedly views women as sex objects and so forth. You know, all that coming from the Access Hollywood tapes and the Miss USA flap and the other, scandals, real and unreal that he's been involved in. So they wore the color pink and they had the hats. But, you know, I'm not put off by those demonstrations. I applaud them. I think they're fabulous. I think that they represent the obvious division in American society today. And I am heartened that there is this check and balance on the president, on Washington, that will hopefully moderate the views of all sides. And I think that when President Trump ponders the fact that millions, literally millions of Americans turned out on that day of protest, he's not going to be cavalier and reckless in his choices. I mean, I know that most people don't like the Dakota pipeline and the Keystone pipeline and things of that nature. They don't like some of the cabinet picks. But, you know, elections have consequences. He has the right to do what he's doing. I hope he does more things like the kind of deferred action on the DACA kids, the Dream Act kids. You know, that to me, that's my red line. The deferred action for the childhood arrivals. If he goes after the Dream Act students, then, you know, it's going to be very hard for me to stay friends. But I don't think he's going to. Sean Spicer made that clear as he could, without alienating all of the people for whom the immigration issue was the most important issue. People on the right, by and large, working class white people who don't like the whole notion of the fact that there are 11 million undocumented people, the illegal immigrants, as they say, in the country. But I'm telling you, these kids, these Dream Act kids, are the most innocent of any undocumented immigrant. They came in through no wrongdoing of their own. They were brought here by their parents, with no free will as youngsters, you know, 2, 3, 1. They grew up here. Now they're 18, 20 years old, 25 years old. You know, they've been here their whole lives. Were you going to deport them to a country that they have no conscious memory of? Very, very unfair. And I was delighted when President Obama cut them some slack. And I'm even happier and more relieved today that President Trump says they're not his priority, the DACA kids, Deferred Action Childhood Arrivals, the DREAM Act students. And just imagine the terror that they are living in, you know, certainly were until Sean Spicer's first big press conference, and he followed it up with the second press conference, press briefing, I should say, making it clear that the undocumented immigrants that President Trump is going to go after are those who are criminals, those who are threats to American society. And that's okay with me. If you come to this country without proper documentation, then you commit a felony, a crime, you rob a bank, or you rob someone, or you rape someone, or you murder someone. You know, you have no right to stay here. You have no right. You should get the hell out. We're going to throw you out. That's okay. I don't mind that, as long as there's a process that weeds out the criminals from Juan and Maria, the avocado pickers. I mean, there's so many jobs that native-born Americans, American citizens, are not going to take anymore. They're not going to pick fruit for those wages. Now, even in the construction trades, there are a lot of jobs in cold, wet places that Americans don't want. But certainly, most Americans don't want to work in poultry processing plants. Most citizen Americans don't want to work in meat packing plants. They don't want to wash dishes in diners. They don't want to deliver pizza at 2 o'clock in the morning in a cold February night in New York City or Chicago or Cleveland. You know, they serve a very vital function in this country, and I think we got to respect that. And he's right. Let Donald Trump go after the bad ones. That's okay with me. In terms of abortion rights, reproductive rights, pro-choice, I really do believe that women have to stay engaged. And I tell you one thing. I tell you one thing that really struck me like a thunderbolt on it's a lightning bolt in a thunderstorm on the day of the protest, the 21st of January. How many of those women actually voted? How many actually showed up and cast their ballot for Hillary Clinton? How many wasted their ballot voting for Jill Stein? Just add them up. Donald Trump won by a crowd that could fit inside the Ann Arbor, Michigan football stadium, distributed over three states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. It was that tight. There were far more people protesting than the margin of Trump's victory in those key Electoral College states. You got to register. You got to vote. You got to stay engaged. That's how you're going to moderate the views of the right, which controls the Senate and the House of Representatives. That's how you're going to control the next pick for the Supreme Court. So in this process, like I said, I am so proud that President Trump follows me on Twitter. I hope you do too. I'm heartened that there's this check and balance. Hopefully it will moderate all sides in this country. I'm determined to be a small voice in the president's ear and the country's ear that says, cool down, everybody. Let's work this out. We're all in this together. And thank you very much for listening. Hope you tune in next time. I'm Peralta Worthen.